Hello and welcome back to Cast. And by that, Jack, what do I mean?
It cast, Georgie.
Hiya, Jackie.
Hiya, Alex.
Oh god, this is so weird already. Yeah. Right, so as you probably gathered from that, that's not just us having too much sugar. We are reviewing and discussing the adaptation of Stephen King's It. Both part one and part two, in an exclusive It cast. Just to warn you in advance, this podcast will have spoilers in it, so please make sure you've seen both part one and part two, or chapter two as it's actually called, isn't
it?
Yeah,
and the 90s one, we might touch on that a bit as well.
Exactly, yeah. 1990, I think. The original two-part TV adaptation starring Tim Curry as Pennywise the Clown. Yeah, so if you haven't seen those, then obviously feel free to listen. We love you listening, and we're always excited to hear your thoughts and comments as well. But it might just be a little trickier, given that we'll be going into some pretty intense details.
Yeah.
Jack, anything else you want to add before we crack on with it?
No, but listen to the podcast and you'll float too!
And now, for our feature presentation, Tom Hanks Defence Force, with your hosts, Alex Halpern and Jack Fryer, a podcast for people who love film, television, and Tom Hanks. Welcome back. We are talking about
It.
It.
Do it.
Yep, Mr. Machete at the helm of this very recent adaptation, the first of which, part one, is the highest grossing horror of all time.
Yeah, budget of $35 million, made $700.4 million at the box office. Obviously that doesn't include streaming rights and DVD sales, rentals, legally bought downloads. So and also all the Pennywise merchandise, like you can get It t-shirts, Funkos.
It's a huge success, a sweeping success amongst kids, particularly under the age of 14.
Yeah, and adults as well.
It's after the two of us.
Yeah.
But then that box office performance is extraordinary for a horror film.
Yeah, the trailers broke records when it was released. Like, I think 9 figures viewed it in a certain amount of time for this, yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I guess you have these landmarks in horror history, so Silence of the Lambs being the first horror to
Silence.
Win. Sorry?
She said silent, it's Silence of the Lambs.
That's what I said.
Did you? I thought you said Silence of the Lambs.
Silent, no. Nah, definitely
Silence.
Silence. So, yeah, Silence of the Lambs. Silence, being the first horror film to win an Oscar.
Yeah.
And then we have this new record for the highest grossing of all time. So whatever Mr. Muschietti has up his sleeve next, we'll see if that matches the raw power of Stephen King. So, Jack, what did you think of... I mean, we'll cut straight to the chase here. What did you think of parts one and two? Was one better than the other? Do you think they lived up to Stephen King's novel? Do you think they... was the part two what you were expecting? And once again, to emphasise, this is a spoiler episode.
Well, obviously, I've never read the novel. I know bits of certain things in the novel that are only to the novel, like The Big Turtle.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Obviously, I did see... The Tim Curry 90s series beforehand, so I did kind of know what was happening anyway. I thought I'd watch it for a bit of reference and to help compare. But they're both their own things. Obviously, the 90s one is quite camp by today's standards. And obviously, this one is more just raw, in-your-face horror. So
yeah, exactly. And I guess the 1990 Tim Curry version, they're relying much less on prosthetics, let alone effects. And whereas this one actually has the... you know, the huge studio budget to really, bring Pennywise to life in a scale that is as monstrous as, a combination of Fuschietti and Stephen King's imaginations, whatever that leads to. Which is, interesting, because I agree with what you're saying about the 1990 version being camp.
My favourite scene in the 90s one is when I think it's Rich is in a library and Pennywise is in it, he's reading and he's just acting like a complete clown, dropping blood balloons, and he goes, "Excuse me, do you have Prince Albert in a can? You do? Well, you better let him out." He's just doing that in the background.
But and even just, then, you have this sort of this violin-driven, like, suspense soundtrack.
Yeah.
And it's and then you have all the balloons popping on all the library goers' faces. It's it's a really yeah, I guess I mean I don't want to say self-aware, but I guess to be fair for them, it was a smart move for them to put it in two parts.
Yeah.
Because both parts are an hour and a half long. So combined, you have this 3-hour epic, which is what the story is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an epic, you know, it's an epic horror.
Yeah, and obviously, for part one is 2 hours 20, part two is 2 hours 40, so it's a 5-hour epic if you put it all together.
It's an extravaganza. It's, but I guess that's, you know, what part two really emphasised. I think part two definitely turned it into the epic that it is. I think, you know, in part two of Muschietti's part two, this is the one that's just been released. That's, you know, that really emphasised how much of a human drama this is, about the power of memory, the power of friendship, these very universal themes which, you know, which really empower the underdog. You know, that's obviously you had these themes that were, you know, very clear in the in part one.
Yeah, obviously they're called themselves the Losers Club for a reason. They're all outcasts, really.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you know, part one it emphasises the fact that they're all doing this together. It's they can only defeat them at it as a solid unit. And
it's about brotherhood and friendship, isn't it? You know, and just reconnecting with your friends and how important it is to do that.
Well, yeah, and you know, the comfort of friends to overcome your fears. And your trauma, I'd say your trauma more so than fears, because, you know, these, you know, most of the losers, if not all of them, suffer from a trauma that is very real on a consistent basis. I guess Mike's trauma comes from the fact that he blames himself, at least in the Muschietti films, on his parents being burned alive in the house and him being too young and too scared to help them.
Yeah.
But then you have very consistent, like, you know, reasons for trauma in the here and now. So like
Eddie's a germaphobe.
Yeah, but which is brought on by his mother, by his mother's constant obsession with, you know, with these harmful bacteria that, you know, in his Eddie's supposed ill health, which I guess, you know, questions whether that is just a placebo, whether he is actually suffering from any of that. And the same thing with Beverly and her abusive father.
Yeah.
A really emotionally abusive father.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess it's, you know, it's the power of friendship that takes people out of this daily consistent trouble, this daily horror. You know, and it makes it look like, you know, the trouble with Henry Bowers and Hochstatter is just, you know, that's the tip of the iceberg. And even then, Bowers has problems with his own father.
Yeah.
He then murders under the influence of Pennywise. Yeah. So it's... I think this film did, going on from that point, do a really good job at emphasising and demonstrating Pennywise's reach over the whole town. Like, he controls its past, present and future. He has his clowny fingers in absolutely everything. So, I mean, did you think that was the case?
Yeah, like, I just felt like you couldn't really get away from Pennywise unless you actually just got out of Derry. You know, you're only safe if you're not in Derry.
But that's the thing, but it was the inevitability of them having to come back.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, as was made clear in this one, according to Mike, if they miss this cycle, then Pennywise would come back and kill them 27 years down the line.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... You know, even if you leave Derry, you can't escape. It's this idea of wanting to escape, but your traumas and your fears can still be very real things if you let your mind play these things over and over again.
Like in the 90s film series, I think it actually still affects them. Like they struggle with relationships to conceive, and it's because of this influence of Pennywise still going on.
Yeah. And that's the thing, and it's and even in this one, in part two, the past is still very much real, and it's almost like these characters have gone cyclical back to the things, the fears that, you know, the things they thought were haunting them, but they actually have some kind of inescapable relationship with.
Yeah.
So in the sense that, you know, Eddie moves away from his emotionally controlling mother to an equally controlling and questionably emotionally abusing
wife.
Yeah. And similarly with, you know, it's almost the exact same thing with Beverly. Horrifically abusive father, you know, emotionally at least, and then questionably physically as well.
Yeah.
And you have the exact same thing with the man she marries.
Yeah, who's this very mother. Physically abusive.
Exactly, yeah. So it's almost like it levels up, even though she has tried to escape from that past. But Pennywise is constantly just sort of controlling their destinies.
And I thought, like, with Bill, how he has got, writes a bad ending, it was like a representation of how he can't write a good ending because he himself has unresolved issues.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, he doesn't know how to resolve things. It's a very Stephen King it's a very Stephen King move to focus on writers who struggle with their craft. You know, who are tortured by their
perfection,
real world.
Yeah,
their pursuit of perfection. And it's, as I think was very clear in this, it's Stephen King really toying with the theme of how complex humanity is and how complex regular humans are. Yeah, which, you know, and it was definitely a very Steve, and both films, part one and two of Machete's adaptations, are very Stephen King films. The things that Pennywise says, it's almost like these little, you know, would-be pop culture references, but are exclusive to Maine during the late 1960s when he wrote it. And it's what am I talking about?
Yeah.
Early 80s, yeah. No, I'm thinking of that film, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, why that jumped into my mind for a second there. Clearly we've had this horror binge that...
And with Stranger Things as well, we've had a big rise, haven't we? We have Stranger Things, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, It, about even Super 8, you know, about young children facing like a big, like an alien or paranormal monsters.
Yeah, and which has become this whole existential crisis because they don't even know what it is and therefore don't know how to kill it.
Because I think that's one of the reasons I preferred one to part two in the same one like the other films, is because obviously, as we were taught in, when we were in college, we were taught in our emotional response film studies lessons that obviously audiences are more scared worried about the fate of things like dogs or children because they're more vulnerable and therefore they're more at risk and on like instincts to protect them are stronger during those scenes.
No, yeah, that's very true. I guess instinct is the ultimate question of whether you survive or not in horror. It's the matter of, do you go with your gut feeling, or do you listen to that irrational voice in your head? Do you think that voice is rational? It's, you know, and it toys with that in both one and two, when you
of course,
have
the
three doors scene.
Yeah.
You know, you have a not scary, a very scary, a not scary at all. It's literally this question of, what your brain is trying to rationalize in terms of whether a creature like Pennywise is playing on you, whether it understands your instincts, so it's expecting you to work against them or for them.
Yeah,
it's a real, I think in both films definitely set it out, like, the idea of these protagonists, the loser's fear is sort of, is laid out on this chessboard, while you have Pennywise on one side and the loser's on the other.
Yeah. And then he had Pennywise's pawns like Henry Bowers and, you know, all the people he was able to manipulate. Hockstatter, all people he was able to manipulate. You know, the balloons would be pawns.
Yeah. it's all this beautiful, horrific game.
Yeah.
I think one thing that I actually really wanted to talk about was, which I thought was, you know, to a greater extent loyal to the book, was how scary the people were.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's you have the bully gang.
Yeah.
You have Bowers, Hockstatter, the other guy with the anthrax t-shirt.
Yeah.
Other blondie that we... that are nameless. But these are clearly, you know, serial killers waiting to happen.
And even the beginning of part two, you had that homophobic gang at the beginning.
Exactly, yeah. The idea that this never leaves the town.
And, you know, the fact that they don't get their comeuppance shows that some people do get away with it, and it's wrong that they do.
And I think it really emphasised that Derry really is, you know, even though it's connected to other parts of, you know, upstate civilization. It really is in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, you know, modern cosmopolitan ideas and liberal ideas just don't reach this place.
It's like, you know, when they're walking through the town when they're adults, it's like, hasn't really changed. It's just stayed the same.
Exactly. It's the same architecture, the same atmosphere, the same colour grading. It's, you know, it's literally this... it's this echo, as Mike described it as.
Yeah.
You know, you think you've changed the town, you think you've defeated Pennywise, but it bounces back 27 years later. Yeah. Just 27 years later, the town is exactly the same.
Then, yeah.
The same in their heads. And it's also, I guess, it's... I think it also ironically works well that it's the same, because in part two, they're trying... You know, the only way they can defeat Pennywise is if they rebuild their memories. When they find tokens, when they just remember these, you know, these little icons of their past that either define their relationships or just define their strength and their and perseverance.
Obviously, and obviously, when they let go of them, it's kind of like we're letting go of the past in a way. You know, we've tackled on, you know, and you know, build
the past burns with the present. You know,
and obviously, what did Mike burn?
He burnt the rocks.
With a rock, yeah. From the rock fight.
The first one.
And obviously we got Bill burnt Georgie's boat, obviously Beverly and, what's his name? Sam of that one. Bill? No. Oh, no, this is really bad. We literally just walked out of it.
Damn it. Is it Ben?
Ben, isn't it? Yeah. Like, obviously they burnt their things which represent each other. Which also shows Burning Love. Bill burns
Richie
the coin.
Richie would be proud.
Yeah. Richie burns the Street Fighter coin. Yeah. And yeah, obviously, it's just a case of they've got to let go of the past to kind of move on in a way, which is kind of defeating Pennywise symbolises that they do move on, you know?
Exactly, yeah. And the fact that, you know, Pennywise, time is something that really... You know, there really does seem chaotic in this. I mean, they can't... You know, it's... You know, I mean, Mike is researching when Pennywise came about so he can destroy him. And their best guess is, like, a couple of million years ago. And even in the books, when Pennywise first arrives, because they actually witness him happening, they basically... The Native American ritual which they conduct, they actually learn it by hand. He doesn't visit a community... They actually do it themselves in their den, in the novel, yeah. And and then they see him. How that happens is you don't have it descending as the Deadlights and then just going to war with this Native American community. You just have Pennywise, you just have all these pre-Ice Age creatures running from this... And this shard of light that is falling from the sky, this falling star, and then it crashes into the earth, and this force of wind, this sheer blistering gale just sweeps everything away in its path. And that's when they realize that's when it came, that's when it arrives. So it's not, you don't see it interacting with any, like, pre-modern dairy humans.
He wasn't the thing that killed the dinosaurs, was he?
But that's the thing. I mean, that's, you know, it's almost this Lovecraftian lack of clarity.
Oh, man, yeah, that's good. Lovecraftian's a good way of putting it, yeah.
Well, yeah, they're sort of indescribable. You know, they never really have a true answer for what Pennywise really is. He is just this transcendental entity. But yeah, my point being that, you know, they don't have clarity as to when he arrived, and they don't have clarity as to, you know, when certain events happen. Their memories are all phasey. And it's just this, you know, the whole film seems to be about this war against, you know, us forgetting the past. Of us not, you know, either not wanting to remember the past, but then at the very beginning when it emphasises that, you know, we form our identities out of the memory, the positive memories, and we use those positive memories to define us. But sometimes, just sometimes, where the things that we want to forget about but can't escape from, you know, it's this idea that memory is subjective, and as a result, time is the wider concept of time can be subjective. So, yeah, that's a real, and I guess Stephen King does that with, like, you know, jumping between narratives. You know, it's non-linear.
Linear, yeah.
But I thought, do you think they did a good job of separating it into part one being about the kids?
Yeah, definitely.
And part two focusing on them as adults? Do you think that works well?
Yeah, because you... Obviously, it helps building the character. You already spent one film with them, so... And also the 2-year gap in between releases. obviously made you want to see what happened to them, and so you kind of stayed with them in such a short period of time. It's only been 2 years between release, so...
Yeah.
And it's really good fun, because you see that you witness them as their kids, and they see them as adults, so you normally know their characters, so they can afford to spend a bit less time developing them, because we already know what they're like.
I thought it was very well cast.
Yeah. Bill Hader was Richie, it was fantastic. That was, like, dead on.
Absolutely. Well, it's just because he looks like Finn Wolfhard.
Yeah. Do you know they had to do a bit of de-aging technology because they had growth spurts?
I'm sure.
Yeah. I thought for some scenes, Finn Wolfhard, I thought he looked a bit strange, and I thought, oh, yeah, that's why.
Yeah, it seemed like his cheeks were a bit chubby. Yeah. But that's actually, that's definitely the de-aging tech.
Yeah.
I mean, he was fantastic in Finn Wolfhard.
Oh, like, God, he's he's a future star in the making.
Yeah. Well,
he'll be the American Nicholas Holt.
Yeah, and even the guy who plays Eddie, his name escapes
me. Child Eddie or adult Eddie?
Adult Eddie.
Oh, James Ranson.
James Ranson, that's it. He, you know, he has this, I mean, like, I've seen him in other roles he's played, he's always had this neuroticism that's accompanied the role. I imagine that was an obvious choice for the producers.
Because he's really good in Generation Kill, where he's a US Marine.
Yeah.
And he just fits that perfectly, but it was good to see him branch out a bit more as Eddie for me. But he's done other things I can't think. But he was actually like, oh, him. He's like, actually just see. It's like, oh, him, you know.
Another brilliance of, oh, actually, it's a very sad story behind this, but why Ben actually, you know, works out to slim down, to lose weight, so, you know, he can actually, you know, I mean, I guess, yeah, I think he's a real example of someone who's like moving on with their lives now. Has actually like changed, you know, both physically as well as emotionally and maturity wise. But you know, but the sad story behind that was because he was, you know, he needs to do that to win Beverly's love.
Yeah.
You know, you see him walking away crying when he realizes she's fallen for Bill.
Yeah.
And that's a really, I guess, you know, for a child of that age who's discovering love for the first time, that's a, yeah, that's a sad, sad thing to be dealing with.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, no, it's an emotional film, and it leaves with a very... Yeah, part two closes with a really great message of being who you are.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I guess, you know, we, you know, in 2019 here and now, we have, you know, like, we have so many things that allow us to be who we are. You know, social media allows us to create, you know, whole new identities, and it's way easier for us to change careers and to move elsewhere and just form these new identities. But, you know, the reality of who we really are and who we act as naturally is just far deeper and far more complex than that. I think the sort of, you know, like Stan's closing letter, his message to the losers and to the world, is just really emphasizes that, like, look, you know, as we've experienced throughout two films, you know, in 27 years, we can't escape who we are. We can't escape who we come from. We can't escape certain memories that define us, but, you know, there's, you know, we do have a freedom to be who we are beyond all that. We can choose our destinies. And yeah, I thought the resolution did justice and was very beautifully played out.
Yeah, I agree. I thought they all the losers as children and adults all played it very well. You know, even like James McAvoy, it felt like at some times he was on autopilot, but he can get away with it because he's James McAvoy, you know.
He does what he wants.
Yeah, and obviously Jessica Chastain.
He can do anything in my film.
Jessica Chastain's kind of cast because obviously she's worked with Machete before when, I probably mispronounced that, in Mama.
Mama, yeah.
And obviously when it got announced as Weird 2, people like saying, were lobbying for Jessica Chastain.
Mm.
And so much he said, yeah, I'll do it. And then,
Are you a little surprised that Guillermo del Toro wasn't involved in producing it?
No, I think he's more interested in like more original properties, I think.
Sure.
Obviously, I know he's wanted to do Mountains of Madness by Lovecraft, and like he's done other adaptations like Blade 2, Hellboy.
Because like he's one of the key monster filmmakers, both in a horror and fantasy context.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously, with his horror films like Mama and Antlers that's coming out next year.
Honestly, yeah, you had
that's, you know, he's
what's coming out next year. Sorry,
Antlers.
Oh, Antlers, yeah, of course.
That looks fantastic. Yeah. Which he's very much behind the helm in producing.
Because of Gary Dolberman, who wrote it too. I think he directed the latest Annabelle film, which was awful, but then he did an absolute amazing job of a screenplay for this one. So, and he also did Blood Monkey, you know, that F. Murray Abraham film, so yeah.
that's a couple of scary scenes, surprisingly.
Yeah.
for a sci-fi film,
I think. But the bit that, I just think it shows you how people can have to do a bad script. Because the people who wrote Endgame and Infinity War wrote Pain and Gain as well. So it shows you they have good scripts and bad scripts, you know.
But no, you're right. And like, I mean, Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, did say there's a massive disparity between, you know, while critics are important for the creative process, there's still a difference between their opinions and what consumers want.
Yeah, because it, funny enough, It Chapter 1 had 86% positive reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. Number 2, it was, I think it's less because I've seen more mixed reviews for It Chapter 2 than 1. But funnily enough, Empire gave number 2 5 stars, which I wasn't expecting. But yeah.
I mean, that is very surprising, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I was talking to my brother this morning, and he was saying that, I was talking to him yesterday, actually, and he was saying, our dad told us that he read a review of It Chapter 2 and just said it's not going to be as good as the first one. Hearing that from my dad was interesting to say the least. But it's a different story almost. I mean, it's, you know, like I said earlier, it turns it from a horror, which the first one was, into an epic, which is what the overall story is.
Because why do you think It is the most successful horror film of all time and potentially franchise? Because, I don't know, do you think it's because of clowns? Because obviously everyone's terrified of clowns.
There's a big element in it, yeah.
Because obviously we've had very many iconic clowns. Obviously we've had the many iterations of the Joker, and there's a fascination with real-life serial killers who are dressed as clowns. Mm. Obviously, we've had the killer clown craze as well, which seems to pop up every Halloween, damn it.
Sure.
And even there's lesser-known clowns, like Art the Clown in Terrifier. You've had Ross Noble in Stitches. You had Clown, and of course, the Eli Roth film. And of course, where he produced it. And of course, who can forget Killer Clowns from Outer Space? So
that timeless classic.
And of course, Clown from Slipknot, and the Insane Clown Posse as well. So...
It's and they're all part of the same universe.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I agree. I think it's definitely a very important factor in it. I think, you know, there are, you know, I mean, there aren't any particularly famous clown horror films that sort of stand up. Apart from, I mean, obviously the Joker, Joker's makeup, but
Pennywise, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But there aren't, apart from that, there aren't any particularly famous, like, household name clown horrors.
Obviously, you could argue Violator in the Spawn franchise, because that's a demonic clown, but...
Yeah, but that's
it's
not...
It's more cult, isn't it, I take it?
Yeah, I have to say it's way more cult-based. But then there are so many people who have a phobia of clowns. I can't remember what the actual
phobia thing is.
Something like that. Yeah. But that is huge. That is a sort of the almost go to phobia.
I'm scared
of clowns.
I was...
But then they haven't seen any of these films.
No.
There wasn't, you know, like, they don't have any particular, you know, moments that make them think, oh, they're scared of clowns. It's just that people are scared by
because
the concept
obviously
of clowns.
Clowns are meant to be kind of goofy, like, you know, clowns are meant to be goofy, like Sideshow Mel and Krusty. But when you think of clowns, people just tend to go through the killer clowns. Because I was actually having a conversation about clowns recently, and someone said, actually did say, what's the phobia of clowns called? And someone said, rational. because it's just sort of the big smiles, and to see them all coming out of that car, the big feet, the happy smiles, the bright costumes, it's
well,
too
so you
much,
don't know
really.
What's beneath that smile.
Yeah.
And a lot of that changed with the serial killer John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, yeah.
Dressed as a clown, murdered a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, horrific.
Yeah.
But that's, so yeah, like, that's where that logical phobia comes from, for sure. But, you know, it's, we're constantly talking about the phobia of clowns. It's something that, you know, whenever you're talking about phobias or horror, clowns is just automatically part of that conversation at some point. And I think, you know, you have a film which is marketed around a killer clown. For people who aren't familiar with the It story, you have Stephen King, you know, the mastermind of horror behind it, and you also have this massive resurgence in, like, millennial horror fans. You know, you look at the popularity of A Quiet Place and Bird Box and Insidious and The Conjuring. Horror is very popular amongst millennials.
Yeah, and Get Out, Us as well.
Exactly, yeah. And it's, you know, one of the most profitable genres.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
cheap budget,
proud,
you know,
to say.
Big box office, you know.
Exactly, yeah. They're money-making machines for people our age and, you know, within a 10-year span.
Yeah.
Spectrum even.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think all these factors together just make it, you know, I just think it makes it so much more appealing. You know, I think a story based around a killer clown terrorizing a clown. A town.
It's clown versus clown.
Terrorizing a town, and particularly with a bunch of kids involved, is long overdue. I think, I should have expected it to be remade before it was announced.
I hate clowns, because during the killer clown craze, I remember a story from an actual clown who was saying it's affected their business, because he once had an offer to a job, and he turned up at the place, and it was literally an abandoned car park, and there were a bunch of people waiting, just drove off, like, nope, I'm not going in there. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And people were, like, actively actively out to get clowns. You know, there's been multiple occasions where street performers dressed as clowns have just been assaulted by a member of the public.
Well, there was the whole, social media clown sighting
Two years ago.
That was late 2016?
Yeah,
wasn't
2015,
it?
16, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I think we were discussing this at the time, and we speculated whether this was marketing for it.
Yeah, if it was, because it was a year, it got announced, and it was a year later.
Rob Zombie's 31.
Yeah, and obviously, because it was in development hell for quite a while. You know, Cary, I can't remember his name.
Fukunawa,
yeah, one who's directing the upcoming Bond film.
True Detective, he
was involved with the screenplay for the first one, because he was going to direct it at one point before he moved on. So, obviously, it had a long development hell before it got released, which generated hype as well. So
yeah, it's a long time in the making.
And you know, it's just obviously that clown thing. Obviously, there were some people I know said they saw clowns, and there was like even somebody I knew claimed they were chased by a clown at 2 a.m.
Oh sure, I mean it's straight up like serial killer material. I mean, those videos are scary just watching them.
I know, and I reckon, and I reckon it'll have a comeback this Halloween, definitely.
I don't know. I mean, it didn't come back in 2017 or 18.
It did very, very, very minor, not enough to like get national media attention. But I've got a feeling it's going to make a comeback. We have a Joker as well coming out in the next month, so you've got two big clowns in the space of a month. There's already fan art of Pennywise and wacky things with Joker hanging out.
Yeah, but I think the whole hype and vibe around Joaquin Phoenix as Joker is that it's not a scary clown. He's not a clown that's going to wait at the end of your road and you're going to stumble across him on Halloween. Like,
he's not going to be standing under your lamppost honking a horn at 1 a.m, is he?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the kind of thing that, you know, in the same way that people watch V for Vendetta and then the Anonymous Mask became instantly popular. You know, it's that, I think people were associated with more of that kind of political action than scaring the local kids. Which is, but you're right. I mean, anything can happen on Halloween. And we just saw Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark the other day. Which a lot of really unpredictable stuff does happen on Halloween. Yeah. But it was really heavily marketed as well, wasn't it? I mean, just even without the whole Stephen King, killer clown craze.
All
of these factors. Like, it was all over the place. Yeah, and a lot of really good marketing behind it.
Because the first one as well, like, apart from, like, arguably Bill Skarsgård and Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things, it didn't have any big names in it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just a case of it was just more, the story itself was just enough to get people out there.
Yeah. And it was, and I guess going back to the killer clown craze, it was, you know, Bill Skarsgård's Pennywise face that was everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it was, I think it was also like, I guess, I don't know, kind of touched on this point, but it's finally like another, like an actual big clown horror.
Yeah.
This is.
And there's been a wave of imitators following it. Like, straight to DVD clown films have come out following it to try and capitalise on this.
Yeah, like Asylum films.
Yeah, and Circus Kane starring Jonathan Lipnicki from Stuart Little.
Called It's. Silence. No, a huge range of factors. And a really good direction. There's a lot of really clever cinematography.
Some great jump scares and a mixture of psychological horror, jump scares, and tension.
Yeah, there are moments that I think just were more unpredictable. Like, it was when young Ben was hiding in the locker from Flaming Hair Beverly, and he's peering out through the slits in his locker.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's the perfect setup for Pennywise appearing in front, his eye is suddenly appearing in front of the slits.
But no.
But the camera pans back and he's in the locker with him.
I know.
It's just such a, it was literally like the writer saying, no, we know what everyone's going to be expecting.
And it's like that scene as well where it's the little girl is, she goes under the stairs at that place to go meet him, under the stairs at that bath baseball game, and he goes 1, 2, and you think it's going to go 3, and there's like a really long pause, and he's like, oh, come on, don't say anything.
Yeah, and that ties really well with the fact that times have changed, which is ironic because we've just been discussing how time doesn't seem to change in Derry, but times have changed because the little girl says, you're not my friend.
Yeah.
It's the whole idea that kids are now aware of stranger danger.
Yeah.
Like, that's taken way more seriously now.
Of course, yeah.
So, so she starts walking away, and so Pennywise has to up his tactics.
Yeah.
And, again, by my understanding that she's waiting for him to magically make her birthmark disappear.
Yeah.
So he knows that she's going to say, you're meant to say 3.
Yeah.
And it's literally, I think that scene just really, really demonstrates how quick-witted Pennywise is.
And how much of a sadist he is. He loves toying with his victims.
Yeah, and how much he knows to up his tactics because, in the moment. Yeah. And he constantly has one more trick up his sleeve. Because, he constantly has this upper edge.
Because he just, it's so many people I know who've seen it said, yeah, it's obviously silly because he could just kill them instantly in so many occasions, but he loves the game because it increases the fear, which therefore increases his hunger.
Which makes him animalistic. Yeah. I mean, lots of animals toy with their food. I mean, cats notoriously toy with mice.
Yeah.
It's a big thing in the animal world as well. I think baboons do it. I think chimpanzees do it. It's a very, I guess those primates are similar to us, but it's a real kind of, almost sort of like apex predator thing for animals to toy with their food and check them out. I mean, sharks stalk their prey.
Of course, yeah.
They don't just go in for the kill instantly. They suss it out.
So, yeah.
They're intelligent creatures, it's what's constantly reminding us that, as well as living up to these serial killer stereotypes. It's he's also animalistic. He's completely inhuman.
Because obviously, in terms of Pennywise, he's been around for so many years, and Machete's even entertained the idea of a prequel series featuring another group of victims of Pennywise. Is that something you'd like to explore, to see more of Pennywise's origins, or do you think it's just best left as it is?
Well, there was one scene I read about that was originally drafted in the script, but was removed, but wasn't actually included in the final, it wasn't actually filmed in the end, which it is one of Pennywise's origin stories, or at least a story of, a community's encounter with Pennywise many generations before. I believe that was in sort of the mid-1800s. Okay. I do and I don't. I think the novel explores Pennywise appearing in various different time, various different periods, which it does very well. Stephen King exhibits some really good atmosphere and tension in these parts of the novel. But like any good killer, you can't give too much away. You can't explore the monster too much. Because part of the beauty of it, which I think is, which the horror genre relies on to a greater extent, is your imagination. It's your imagination doing the work. You're not revealing who these monsters are down to their core. And the idea of learning too much about Hannibal Lecter is troubling, in my opinion. And I guess that's why a lot of people reviewed Hannibal Rising quite negatively, just because the charm of Hannibal was the complete mystery that surrounds his aura.
And again, I've mentioned this before, but the Rob Zombie Halloween films, because it's much more scarier for Michael Myers just being a normal kid to kill his sister for no reason than to have an abusive upbringing, which would make him snap,
Yeah, exactly. And, where... you know, we hear about these stories all the time. Like, you know, we're you know, just
obsessed with dangerously
obsessed. We're obsessed with true crime.
You know, because there's always a really good tweet, like 2009, who's your favourite serial killer? Call the police. 2019, who's your favourite serial killer? Well, I can tell you that, you know.
Yeah, it's... And like, yeah, the wave of true crime documentaries that have been storming Netflix over the past couple of years. You know, it's... So, like, we're constantly, like... You know, we have this obsession with finding out who these monsters are, these real world monsters, and what their motivations were, and what caused them to become this way. But you know, with something as transcendental as it, and it's something that I think is really going to honor our, you know, our love of the mystery as a horror audience.
Yeah,
it just, I don't think there should be an origin series. No. I think that's... I think you could be playing with fire there.
Yeah, of course, yeah. There's a few more questions I do want to ask you. I want to pick your brain on. Who do you think was the better Pennywise? Tim Curry, Bill Skarsgård, or you can't really compare them because they're both two different iterations?
Yeah, I think they're different interpretations from different eras.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, I mean, a lot of people would very fairly say Tim Curry.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he's known to be the original creepy Pennywise.
Yeah, he's more of a clown. Because Bill Skarsgård's more of a Joker-esque, just
psychopath. Well, yeah, like he's more of a monster. Like, you see him as a shapeshifter.
Yeah.
You know, you only really see... Yeah, obviously, in the 1990 version, he does transform. But you don't see him transform directly unless, like, he's baring his teeth.
Yeah.
It's so, yeah, he's more of a serial killer. He's more of a John Wayne Gacy monster.
I thought they were both great, though.
Yeah. But I think in terms of... I could be wrong on this, and please correct me if I'm wrong, and please tweet us if I'm wrong. But I feel like Skarsgård really... I feel like he was given a script and just put in more of an effort to play with... To play with like Pennywise's potential,
yeah.
I feel like he went into a lot more detail in terms of like creating a design for Pennywise, like creating the smile and the, you know, his eye movements and his bodily movements. I feel like it was much more of him as like an actor thinking more entrepreneurially about how to take Pennywise to the next level, whereas Tim Curry seemed to be, you know, doing his best like scary clown impression. But I appreciate that was that was limited to the capabilities of horror at the time.
Yeah, obviously technology's improved massively in the 27 odd so years it's been.
Yeah, and expectations of horror have changed. Yeah. And Tim Curry, you know, we've emphasized this before, but he was incredible. He did a really good, scary job.
Because the thing about the 90s one is no one remembers any of the cast but Tim Curry.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and that's a testimony to his performance.
Yeah, of course.
Who do you think?
Skarsgård is proper creepy, but there's something a lot funnier about Tim Curry.
Yeah.
Because Pennywise does have a dark sense of humour.
Sure, and it's like... They don't hide how entertaining Pennywise can be.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he riffs jokes.
Yeah.
Like, he's funny at times. He's, you know, he has a sense of humour. Which I guess goes back to the part about him, the idea that he toys with this prey. But yeah, no, you're right, I agree. You're absolutely right.
What do you think of Stephen King's cameo?
I think to be fair, in hindsight, I should have expected it because he's had cameos in lots of adaptations.
Yeah.
He's not in the 1990 version. Unfortunately, but it was great. I mean, I've seen a previous criticism where a critic thought that he shouldn't have had as many lines, but I thought that he did the job pretty well.
Yeah.
I think as the sort of old, you know, quite skeptic. Porn shopkeeper. He was,
and I felt like when he was criticizing, you know, Bill's novel. I felt like in a way he was criticizing his own work in a way. Like he might have been thinking of his own books, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I get the feeling that Stephen King has been wrestling with this. You know, that possibility for some time. His novels don't end as well as he initially plans them to.
Yeah, once it's published, like, oh no, you can't really go back and rewrite it.
Yeah, so, but lots of writers have that. That's a very common thing, as with any perfectionist.
Yeah, and it's just a case that I feel like, in a way, he was like just kind of criticizing himself and, you know, having a bit of fun with it, you know, criticizing the book, you know. I thought it was a fun cameo, and it didn't detract too much from the plot as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't very me. It was like, oh, look, there's Stephen King.
Yeah.
He's the author.
It's just, I thought it was good. So, yeah, Stephen King, I thought it was good fun. What do you think about the Here's Johnny joke as well?
I thought it was fantastic. Yeah. There's like, the theory that all Stephen King novels are connected by the same universe has been running for a while.
Yeah, the whole multiverse,
a long-running theory, yeah. And given there are so many, you know, like Doctor Sleep is coming out, the same as The Shining, and the fact that Doctor Sleep is coming out, so we've had two Stephen King adaptations in a very short span of time.
Obviously, all the Netflix stuff as well we've had recently as well.
Yeah, exactly, like Gerald's Game. I think that's really sort of. I think it's doing wonders for Stephen King that a younger generation is now becoming much more familiar with his work. A younger generation that is now.
And Pet Sematary as well.
Pet Sematary, yeah, exactly. Good shout. Which I think. I mean, do you think that opens up the possibility of more of a connected universe?
Yeah.
A multiverse?
Like, I don't know if we'll see, like, James McAvoy's Bill pop up in, like, Doctor Sleep, for example. I don't think we'll see him walking in the street, like, he's shopping, like, hello, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't, like, if they sort of do another Dark Tower series, but...
There's going to be a Dark Tower Amazon series, so it's not like a film, because a film just wasn't much cop, if I'm honest with you.
I mean, that depends on, like, property that the studio is on as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's a... I thought it was a great little reference.
I wasn't expecting it as well.
Yeah, and given that it is sort of, you know, one of the canonical Stephen King texts, I think it was a real shout out to
like,
SK fans.
Because obviously The Shining or It, there's a debate which is the most known King adaptation. Is it Carrie, Misery, It, The Shining?
The Shining.
but I thought it was just a nice little log. As in The Lion King as well, there was a Little Mermaid joke in that as well.
Yeah, there's a song, isn't there, from Beauty and the Beast.
I think Beauty and the Beast, I think that was it, yeah.
Beauty and the Beast, yeah.
That was it. Whoops.
Did you have any other questions or any further comments you wanted to throw out
there?
Yeah,
I get the point why, because there was rumours the turtle was going to be in it, but I think it could have been too hard to adapt, and I think it would take a lot...
It's too difficult to translate.
And it would have taken a lot of the audience out of the film quite a lot. You know, cause the turtle is the Tom Bombadil of the It franchise. You know, it's been hard to take to screen.
Yeah, and I guess there's Stephen. I guess it's like, you know, what is a Pennywise's ultimate nemesis in a transcendental context? You know, it would have brought the film to an even greater scale. But then, given the whole build up from during the marketing of Part One was all about the war that these kids have with this monster. It just would have, I think it would have taken away from the fact that the story is all about the losers gang fighting Pennywise. It's, you know, I think they did a good job of just grounding it to just, this is a war between insecure, isolated kids against this monster that embodies all of their fears and traumas. You know, I don't think you need any of these, you didn't need any of these extra, like, transcendental elements.
Yeah, I get...
It would have detracted from that.
Like...
You know, just that very focused war between the two of them.
I understand why certain fans were disappointed because they had more time to play with, and I thought, great, we might finally get the turtle, but no.
Yeah, but maybe if there is that, I mean, if there is that series that explores
its
origins, then I'm sure we would see the turtle.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure the producers wouldn't be close to the idea.
I'm interested in Machete's career next. Obviously, he's... Obviously, every studio wants a piece of him now because he's doing The Flash next.
Yeah,
and he's
most bankable horror of all time.
Yeah, he's got The Flash line, the long delayed and problematic Flash film up next, and he's doing the live action Attack on Titan next. But
yeah.
I think after those two, I think he'll return to horror, do something a bit smaller, you know.
Because
I've said what Sam Raimi did after 3 Spider-Man films, he was like, no, I'm going to do a small horror film, so he did Drag Me to Hell.
Well, I mean, Guillermo del Toro. Does a big studio blockbuster so he can fund his more his independent
films. His more personal things, you know.
Exactly, which, you know, I mean, we could see Machete following that path, or we could see him going from strength to strength with Marvel and DC films. It's a real, you know, the world is his oyster.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens to him, you know, and I think a lot of, I don't know how much it will change the cast, but I think obviously with the success of, like, Barry on HBO, I think Bill Hader's going to do a lot more dramatic roles now, I think.
Yeah.
He's done a few already, but...
But comedians do this. I mean, we were discussing this the other day.
Steve Carell,
Eric
Jonah Hill.
Banner.
Jonah Hill.
Yeah, I mean, Sacha Baron Cohen now with The Spy. That's... You know, I mean, it's a good.
John C. Reilly's already walked that line. You know, he's done things like Gangs of New York. He's also done stuff like Talladega Nights. So yeah.
But I mean, it's a great opportunity if comedians can demonstrate they can actually perform in dramas. A because it like elongates their careers, but also because it's, you know, when award season comes about, then
yeah,
you know,
definitely
they can they have a lot of glossy opportunities there too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Defo. It's an interesting time. Award season is going to be, but I don't know if it's got people saying Bill Hader's going to be a dark horse for Oscar. I don't know if that'll be the case,
no,
but
I mean, no offense, Bill. I mean, his performance was fantastic for sure, but I can't see it personally.
No, I can't either, to be honest. I do love Bill Hader, but yeah, I just can't see it.
Yeah. He's
The Stranger Things have happened, so woohoo. Stranger Things to doom.
Absolutely. It's yeah, Netflix, you can take that one for a comedy special.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think
that's it. Yeah, we wrapped it up.
That sums up, of course, very nicely. I'm sure we'll have plenty more thoughts that we'll discuss on Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
So when we're interacting with all of you other lovely podcasters,
yeah,
then we'll throw our thoughts in there left, right and centre.
Yeah.
Jack, any final comments?
No, but I think it's going to be great to see Pennywise now, a bit
it's
more of a cult icon. Yeah, it's great to see you too. Yeah.
All right, get some sleep, everyone, yeah, because when we publish this, it may or may not be a school night. Stay in, there's a curfew because it is out. You know, haunting your drains. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Tom Hanks Defense Force. Find us and join the conversation on Twitter and Facebook.